been watching Father Ted.
Oh, really?
On Amazon. Yeah.
Unfortunately, a great show.
It truly is a great show. And you can tell that they like gave up on regular premises by the time they get to series three. They're like, mm-hmm. we're going to make this exceptionally weird now.
They're just going to do Speed.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Speed episode yet?
No, I haven't. Just got two episodes in. Of course, I finally got to the, I heard you're a racist now, Father.
They do Speed with a golf cart.
Okay. Oh, they do the plot of the movie Speed.
Yes, I thought you meant that they do Speed together.
There's been a lot of that going on, you know.
Yeah.
The Nazi guy just accidentally taking his suicide cyanide.
Unfortunately, I mean, look, Graham Linehan is a monstrous person who unfortunately made some of the greatest TV.
Well, and that's what it is. It's like it's really somebody who changed, who drove himself totally insane.
Yeah.
And in the process alienated his spouse, his family. There was some guy who was like posting on Twitter like a couple weeks ago, like, I've always been like this big fan of Graham Linehan. I remember seeing him at some big show at some point in time. And now just what a world it is. I'm driving him to buy him a Big Mac before he does a show in some basement somewhere. And it's like, yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And here's the thing, you know, for all the people just saying, you know, J.K. Rowling just revealed who she always was, I genuinely think that she also got worse.
Yeah, I mean, like, you just look at the page counts of her books, right?
They get increasingly
There's no reason for a fucking mystery novel to be 1,000 pages long.
Right, right. And we're talking post-Potter. Yeah.
Yeah, like, look at what she was writing as J.K. Rowling and then what she writes as Robert Galbraith, and it's all significantly worse, right? She's got the Ayn Rand situation where she doesn't have to have anyone edit her.
Yeah.
And
look, ugh. I've seen the Fantastic Beasts films. I know she has no editor. She has no one saying, hey, Joe, maybe stop.
Well, she was never a screenwriter either.
No.
So like that's all on her.
Yeah, they are very novelistic, those movies, in a fascinatingly, like, awful way.
Yeah.
They're so torturous to sit through. Wait, hold on. Wait, what show is this?
I'm so glad you asked, AJ, because you right now are listening to Fancy Movie Time! The fancy film podcast for fancy folks. I'm Fancy Brian.
And I'm Fancy AJ. And in this episode, we grab our brooms and sweep the streets of Honoreen, Texas, as we cover Peter Bogdanovich's 1971 coming-of-rage drama, The Last Picture Show.
The Last Picture Show. It's all about how there was a show that they'd pull up a little curtain like a peep show, but it was all pictures.
Ooh. Yeah,
and then they'd lower the curtain again.
It's all baseball films all the way down. It's just nothing but pictures. So,
I was
Brian,
thinking like for water or Kool-Aid.
Oh, sure, sure. Just that's where the Kool-Aid Man came from. He was the original pitcher show.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Brian, we are here today to talk about a bummer of a movie.
Yeah,
I'll just come out and say it. We're gonna make like my ancestors and dig around the bog for some peat. Specifically, Peter Bogdanovich.
There we go. Yeah.
The man who Robert Eggers' 2016 film is based on, The Vitch. We're getting really into
A man who you can say so many things about with his actual involvement with movies.
Yes.
And instead, you're talking about Robert Eggers, the Eggers brothers, and their witch movie. It's a W, but it's just how, it's just another, you know.
Brian.
The Vitch.
Brian. Wouldst thou like to live Bogdanovichly?
Oh, that didn't work at all. I had your number. I was like, we're going to talk about The Sopranos for a little bit.
Yeah, well, kind of. We definitely will do that because I think that was my... Yeah, that was my first exposure to Peter Bogdanovich was 100% The Sopranos. If any of our listeners out there, if your first exposure to Bogdanovich was his involvement with The Other Side of the Wind, seek help. But also, like, I did not realize.
I think there were a couple different people from. I think someone else in this movie was in The Other Side of the Wind too.
Oh, possibly.
Yeah.
I think it's just very interesting that, like, he is so interwoven with the story of Orson Welles, particularly like later period Orson Welles, that I obviously missed him because I had not even seen Citizen Kane. So to like have known about any of that stuff, but he's also done like, you know, What's Up, Doc, which is
that's my first Bogdanovich.
Yeah, which I have not seen. Are you a fan of that film? Are you a fan of Peter Bogdanovich's work in general?
I am a fucking huge fan of What's Up, Doc. You've got Ryan O'Neal as maybe one of the hottest people who's ever been on screen in that movie.
Oh, sure.
Madeline, I mean, it's so funny because at the time it was seen, I know, by Pauline Kael. I've never been a big fan of Pauline Kael. Sorry, I'm putting that hot take out there. But she made this whole point of like, is film really old enough that we can start referencing it in movies? And
oh,
I was like,
my God.
Yes, Pauline. And they were already doing that in the 1910s. Come on. Pack up. Yeah. Go home.
On a scale of like Cary Grant's ass to not Cary Grant's ass,
AJ,
how close is Ryan O'Neal?
What I'm going to say is watch the movie.
Okay. All right. I will.
Just watch the movie. You're going to have a really good time.
We don't even talk about it. We won't even talk about it on here. We're just, I'm
no,
going to
just
do
watch
it for
the
my
movie.
Own enjoyment.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes I can just enjoy things. I'm working on that.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes I like to feel very sad about things, which is why we watched this
AJ,
movie, I guess.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just going to talk about What's Up, Doc again for a second.
Sure,
here.
Please.
Do you love it when there's like a foreign guy and he has a very simple monosyllabic first name, and then because of his slight accent, people hear his name as a regular word, and then it leads to a sort of Abbott and Costello situation?
I yeah, sure.
Then guess what? That happens in that movie.
Okay, great. I mean, I was in a production of The Foreigner, so
exactly. It's
like
also something that
right
you
in.
Would do. It's something that you would do. Not necessarily something that you have done, but it's...
Misunderstand people's accents?
No. Come up with a gag like that.
Oh, sure. I do enjoy a good racism every now and again.
Okay, he's white, first
okay,
of all.
Okay, then it's fine. You know what? Then it's fine.
It's regular anti-white racism.
Great. I'm a huge fan of that. More, I would say, of that. So you had seen What's Up, Doc before.
Yeah.
Had you seen anything else in Bogdanovich's filmography?
You know, I'm looking through it right now to see if I have. Oh, yes. Actually, I may have seen this before I saw What's Up, Dog. I saw Mask a long time ago.
Not The Mask. Not somebody.
Mask is about a teenager named Rusty who's been raised by Cher, but he has a facial deformity, sort of like the Elephant Man.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a different condition that led to his deformity. It's Eric Stoltz.
Nice. Back to the Future or during Back? Actually,
oh,
it's post Back
post,
to the Future.
Yes,
yeah,
the
yeah.
90s. No, no, no. It's
85.
So it's like around the same time then. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So
I thought it was later than that for some reason.
He gets fired from Back to the Future and then like throws himself wholly into a Bogdanovich flick. Not a bad pivot, honestly.
No.
Pretty good pivot.
He never quite got his star turn, Eric Stoltz.
No.
You know, he's been successful, but he's always come so close. Like when you look at like Tarantino's casting suggestions for Pulp Fiction, Eric Stoltz was in the running for a lot of the main characters instead of the character that he got.
Oh my God. Yeah, Lance, he plays in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, but he was originally supposed but he was in the consideration for just about everybody in the main cast. Except for Marcellus Wallace, maybe.
It is incredible looking at Eric Stoltz's whole like filmography and being like, he has consistently worked since then.
Yeah.
It's just in pretty much nothing that I have ever seen.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So I'm familiar with the early phase of Bogdanovich, and he's really important and everything, but no, I haven't seen Paper Moon or At Long Last Love or
the sequel to this film, Texasville.
No, I have not seen Texasville.
It comes on the Criterion disc. They've done the one where it's in black and white, and in order to like make it more like in line with the Last Picture Show. And I watched a little bit of it, and it's okay. You know, it's fine. It's trying to sort of tackle the same sort of subjects, but from a more like middle-aged crisis kind of way. Mm. And it is
that doesn't sound interesting to me at all, actually.
Yeah. No, it's fine.
Because I feel like you're already getting that in this movie with the adult characters.
Yeah, with the older characters. And I genuinely think that the end of this movie only makes sense in my head if Jeff Bridges' character dies in the war after he goes off to it. But no, he's alive and well, and married someone else, I guess. The only Bogdanovich flick that I had seen prior to Last Picture Show was his adaptation of Noises Off for the film adaptation of
Noises
Off.
That?
Yeah, he sure did.
That's not a great movie.
It is not a good movie. Mostly because you...
Yeah, you can't really make it a great movie.
You have to sit there and like be in the audience for it. It's the best farce I think ever written or will ever be written, or I guess best British farce that has been written or will ever be written. And to watch it on screen, it deflates it entirely.
Yeah.
They also had to cut out a couple of the gags to make it a little shorter because I think Noises Off runs like two and a half.
Yeah, it makes full use of its three acts. I guess probably act three is the one you could cut the most out of if you want to. But like, God, it's such a good payoff in a theater to just watch them all. Like they have suffered and now they're at the end and they die. They don't actually die for the listeners, but like it might as well.
They might as well. And it is interesting. Have you ever done it, Brian?
No, I haven't. I came very close to the opportunity to do it once, and then I moved away from where it was being done. So,
No, who were you up for? What role?
No, it was like before the audition rolled around. But,
oh, okay. I played Freddy twice, once in high school and then once professionally. And it's so interesting learning the lines for that thing because you have to learn three different versions of the same act.
Yeah.
Because Michael Frayn does this really remarkable thing where the choreography times out with the show, but he's cut lines out of the show in order to make it match the choreography.
Wow, it's very Beckett.
So basically you're doing like a reduced version of each one as the plays go along. And it's lovely. It's a great time. Not a great film, but it is also the reason that my good buddy actually got into theater because he watched Noises Off and the movie and was like, I want to do that on the stage.
Yeah, enough of the material was still there that it was like
you see
cool.
The bones of it and you're like, yeah, hell yeah. But we are here today to talk about a much earlier Bogdanovich picture. In fact, his second one.
I thought it was his last one.
Oh, no. It should have been. I think
he should have retired at like 20.
He was 32 years old when the Last Picture Show was released in 1971. Before that, he had directed exactly one film, one narrative film, which is called Targets. And I have not seen it, but it looks to be a crime thriller, just like a sort of straight down the barrel crime thriller. It wasn't until Last Picture Show that he really got put on the map because, you know, this thing comes out and then it wins so many Academy Awards. It's nominated for 8 of them. He was living with Orson Welles at the time, who like advised him on a lot of things. The reason why it's in black and white is because of Orson Welles. It's just like, it will make it feel more nostalgic.
Yeah, it feels like 1951. Should note that Targets was something that Roger Corman produced. So Bogdanovich is another one of those people who did a B movie for Roger Corman. Worked on, you know, it was like a budget of like $100,000. But he also lucked out. Maybe this was the Wells connection. I don't know. Boris Karloff is the star of that movie.
Oh, shit.
And he was very old at that point. Died like the next year. Yeah, it was a year before Karloff died.
Wow. Got in right. Right under the gun.
So, you know, just the fucking Bela Lugosi. Last movies he does are all with Ed Wood. And then Boris Karloff gets to go out with, like, The Grinch and Peter Bogdanovich.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not a bad run. I think what's really funny is that the guy who plays Sam the Lion in this, Ben Johnson, who we'll talk about a little bit later, I had assumed this would be his last performance because it kind of feels that way. Mm. And then he did movies for, like, the next 20 years or so.
He's not that old.
No, I know, but there's something that feels so final about this. You know, it feels so definitive. It's like it should be the cap on his long career.
It's his
doing
Lear.
Westerns.
Yeah,
and then he does Red Dawn in the 80s instead.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people do Lear young. James Earl Jones was like not even 40, I think, when he did Lear.
Man,
and you can watch it.
It's nice work if you can get it. Yeah, you sent that to me. It's tremendous. And also, since this is fancy movie time and he had such a huge impact, obviously, on cinema, R.I.P. James Earl Jones. Holy shit. I don't know if we're ever going to get another one like you.
Well, thanks to the wonders of AI.
No!
And a Ukrainian
we're
company.
We're
going to
be hearing him for
Re-Speecher.
A long, long time.
Yeah.
Oh,
he's
boy.
Like the test. I guess he and Peter Cushing were the testing grounds for the horrible future that awaits.
If you want some like James Earl Jones stories that you might not have heard before, I'd really recommend the book Free for All, which is about the founding of the public theater and mostly about Joe Papp, who founded the public theater. But James Earl Jones did Shakespeare in the Park there for many, 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 many years.
Which is where he did Lear,
which is where he did Lear. And there's a lot, he's interviewed for the book and just tells a lot of stories about what it was like in the very like first couple of festivals where like there were just like wild animals invading their space. It's really quite a bit of fun. But speaking of legends going out to pasture, The Last Picture Show, a film you did not watch before. I had also never seen it before. The closest thing I can sort of equate it to is like Friday Night Lights in terms of like vibe and mood. I'm pretty sure that the town that it takes place in, the fictional town of Anarene, Texas, it feels like I have driven through that town on my way driving from San Diego to visit my sister in Texas.
Yeah.
I drove through West Texas, and this is supposed to be like North Texas, but I'm pretty sure I drove through this exact town. Like, that's what it looks like. It's just a couple of streets, couple of businesses, but mostly for the most part, like abandoned. Did you ever sojourn out to Texas in your time growing up in New Mexico, Brian?
Not on purpose.
Just on accident you found yourself.
Well, you got to drive through it to get to a lot of places. So I've driven through Texas a number of times, mainly the Panhandle. That's where I-40 runs through. And it's actually, that's probably the nicest stretch of the drive that you will have on I-40 is going through the Texas Panhandle. The roads are very well maintained. Texans are across the board bad people down to the last.
Don't do this.
You know, the old joke, you know, why is New Mexico so windy is because Texas sucks. And then you could also do because Arizona blows.
We will have war declared on us, Brian. We will have absolute war.
Okay, when's the last time Texas won a war?
I feel like I should be
They never really did.
I feel like I should be remembering something, right? But that's also a loss.
Yeah, no, they got their asses fucking ganked. Mm. Down there, Davy Crockett died. They fucked up so bad they killed Davy Crockett.
But he's the king of the wild frontier.
Billy Bob Thornton was right there in that movie I saw and no one else did, getting run through.
Was it just called bayonets. The Alamo? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it was just called The Alamo. If I remember correctly, it was fine. It was a perfectly fine movie. Again, though, it has that disease where we have to end it on a triumph, like Pearl Harbor. So we have to get to like the next thing that happened where where Texans finally win a battle.
So they go to where? Mexico? Like what's
well, yeah, it's still in, I don't know. It depends on how you want to define it, I guess. So then, of course, they join the Confederacy and get beaten again.
Right.
That's 0-2, Alamo and the Civil War.
Okay.
Sorry about your slaves. Not really, though. Suck my dick. Eat my shit. Mm-hmm. All of your fucking state, and
I mean, look, there are people who, I mean, there are Texans who are trapped under a really draconian system of government.
They deserve it. They deserve worse. In fact, like they need to be kept under control.
You should see them
change lanes. They need to be kept under control.
As somebody who has visited Texas a lot of times, there are a lot of wonderful people there, Brian.
I also did a mission trip to Texas. We were really spreading the gospel to fucking people in Texas.
Hello, fellow singer. Allow me to preach to you.
Yeah, I remember staying at like some horrible little fucking like hostel thing in like Lubbock. Or was it
Lubbock?
I don't even remember. Yeah.
Where is Lubbock?
It's in Texas.
All right. Fair enough.
I have visited Texas so many times. I've never heard of Lubbock. Next, you're going to tell me you've never heard of Amarillo.
I know Amarillo. Of course I do.
Oh, do you know? Okay.
It was in Red Dead Redemption. So
that's not true.
It's Armadillo.
Yeah, but there are no real towns in it. It's
I know, but
fake
it's a riff.
States and
it's a rivet. And Amarillo, I'm pretty sure, has been referenced in like country songs.
But yeah, so the author of the book
can't rhyme Lubbock with anything.
Yes, you can.
Name one thing you can rhyme it with.
Hubbock.
I'll hub your ick.
Yeah, it's a strange feeling you get in your heart when you see your girl. Your heart goes all hubbock, hubbock, hubbock. You go Hubbock, 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 and you ride on down to Lubbock. See? See right there. Easy to rhyme.
You missed your calling as a country singer.
Yeah.
But then I think the real problem was you'd get up to the mic in Texas and say you all suck, and then you'd be shot immediately.
I'd have a Blues Brothers situation that would lead
you'd become a target.
Yeah.
Speaking of targets, Peter Bogdanovich.
Yeah. Well, so what I'm saying is Wichita Falls is what this place is based on.
Yes.
And it's...
Well, Wichita Falls is also in the movie.
Right. Yes, it's referenced in the movie. That's a classic way of like doing a little misdirection. No, it's not actually Wichita Falls, but it is Wichita Falls.
But it is adjacent.
That's where Larry McMurtry, the guy who wrote the book, the very autobiographical book, is based on. That's where he grew up.
He also co-wrote the screenplay with Bogdanovich. And also
which he just did for all of the screenplays based on his books. Like Lonesome Dove. Very interesting.
And I think he does a very good job with the screenplay for this one. And it retains, like, I've not read the book, but it retains, I think, enough of the material without feeling like a novel, J.K. Rowling. So we get to...
Also, just a more interesting novel than, you know, Witches in America or whatever.
Well...
The magic only spins forward.
A not... Gay Fantasia. So I sit down to watch this movie. I have no idea what to expect from it. I'd imagine
I thought this was gonna be about movies.
Yeah, me too. But it turns out it's about sort of the death of America and how everything that you want will eventually crumble beneath you. And the best thing that you can do is kind of just soldier on.
Yeah.
And occasionally sleep with a teenager?
Or be a teenager and sleep with an adult.
Yeah.
Be slept with.
Oh, boy.
Be with slept.
Just deeply strange.
Yeah.
Deeply unsettling.
I think it's really interesting because it's like, this is the, when we say make America great again, this is what we're talking about, right? 1951.
Yes.
We're talking about this point where there was so much economic upward mobility and... This guy is writing about his actual experience in the post-war period in the shittiest fucking place in the world, which is Texas.
Well, specifically this town of Anarene, because when
the
this
whole
thing,
state.
Specifically this fictional town of Anarene. Because this movie opens up and it's just like an abandoned ghost town.
Yeah.
My first note is just like, where the hell is anyone?
It's like an oil town that's past the boom days. It still has people working in oil. But that's the thing is, like, an oil job only lasts for a certain amount of time. And the farther technology advances, the fewer people that you need around. And so by this point, it's kind of a skeleton crew taking care of this whole thing. And the main street, all the stores and all the, you know, everything, including the movie theater by the end, it's done. This town is done.
It is over, and yet there is a sequel to this movie set in the same town. So it somehow like finds that way of surviving and coming back around.
Yeah.
But the first thing we speaking of that movie theater, the first thing we see is in fact that movie theater, and it's playing Father of the Bride, which that was a fun way to learn that movie was a remake.
Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah.
Nope. I'm just like, Steve Martin is eternal. He has looked.
There aren't even any lions in
20.
It. Aren't even
it's
any.
Father of the Pride.
Yeah, it's also based Father on the movie.
Yeah. Siegfried and wrong, Brian. Siegfried and wrong. So the movie opens and we see our protagonist, Sonny, who is driving his beat up shit ass car. Mm-hmm. And like everyone in the town of Anarene is just trying to keep this beat up thing still running.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs into his little buddy, Billy, who is sweeping the streets, who has a learning disability of some.
Yeah, he's like nonverbal.
Yes.
He seems very nice and they all keep him around. But Yeah.
Sonny flips his hat around as like a little thing of endearment. And, you know, Billy really seems to dig when that happens. But Billy works for the general convenience store. And we have this wonderful scene where we get to know the two characters by Sonny going in and like playing pool and everybody in town just giving him shit for being the worst football player in the history of the town.
Yeah, no, this is why, again, this is like Oklahoma's like this, too. There all these adults who have nothing else going on in their fucking lives and decide that the only thing that matters is the high school football team. Like you were saying, like Friday Night Lights. This is a very real thing.
Yeah.
You know, because I grew up a little tiny bit in Oklahoma. We lived there for a couple years when I was a little kid.
Oh, that's right. I always forget about
that. And my brother went through kindergarten while we were in Oklahoma. And at the end of kindergarten, the teacher came up to my mom and sat her down and was like, "We want to hold your son back for a year." Not because he wasn't performing well in school, but because they do that to kids who they think might be good football players so that they're bigger and heavier once they get, because it's not, you know, it's not a weight class, it's an age bracket. And so in Oklahoma at this point in time, instead of just holding him back and doing kindergarten twice, which a lot of people do, they had come up with some sort of bizarre one-half year class between kindergarten and first grade. So my mom had to like talk the teachers out of holding my brother back for no reason, just so he could be like a football player. My brother never played football. So that...
Well, I mean, thank God. That sounds like a nightmare. Also, you know, the head injuries.
Yes. And other injuries.
All of the other injuries. We're also introduced to a baby Jeff Bridges as fucking Dwayne. His name isn't fucking Dwayne. However, he's a little fuckhead. And he is already talks like the dude. Like, he's already got, he's already like has this like bass baritone voice, is like a 17-year-old, and he and Sonny are best friends.
He's not 17.
I know, but like the character is 17.
He's like 22.
Yeah. But he's already talking like, hey there, buddy, you missed the tackle there the other day.
It's a comic exaggeration.
It is exactly, I will die on this hill. It is a perfect impression of him in this film.
But yeah, I mean, you get tons of these young faces of like, holy shit, like, that's Eileen Brennan. That's, that's Cloris Leachman. That's Ellen Burstyn. That's Sybil Shepherd.
Yeah, Sybil Shepherd's first role.
And then like way later, it's like, oh, there's Randy Quaid.
Okay, so here's a fun story about Randy Quaid. I watched this with my roommate David, and when that character came on screen that Randy Quaid plays, David's like, "Oh, this Randy Quaid ass motherfucker." And then we reach the end of the film and it's actually just Randy Quaid.
Who did he think it was?
We don't know.
He's so distinctive. He already looked like Cousin Eddie there.
He does.
And their teacher is Higgins from Magnum P.I.
We did briefly think it was Paul F. Tompkins. We just referred to the teacher as Paul F. Tompkins.
That is John Hillerman.
I know. Similar styles, though. Little mustache, little suit.
That is John Hillerman.
He is
Higgins on Magnum P.I.
Okay.
Show respect.
Show I haven't seen.
For Higgins.
I will show my due deference to Higgins. Oh, also another fun fact is that Sonny and Billy are brothers in real life. That's Timothy Bottoms and Sam Bottoms.
Yeah, the Bottoms boys.
The Bottoms boys. And God, Timothy Bottoms is so good in this movie. The acting pretty much across the board is remarkable in this film. I think that...
And Timothy Bottoms is
feels
like 19.
So lived in.
Yeah.
Yeah. He really looks like a wee baby. And so does Sybil Shepherd. Obviously, this is her first role that she'd ever done. Bogdanovich discovered her, and they would go on to work together in several films over the years.
Yeah, Timothy Bottoms hasn't had that kind of star career, really.
He really hasn't.
He was in Johnny Got His Gun the same year as this, actually. And I don't know, it just didn't leverage out for him. I don't really know his story. The last movie that he's in, according to IMDb, is Tar. And it's not that one.
Oh, I was going to say, who was it?
That came out in 2020 that's called Tar. And it's a horror movie about a creature that emerges from La Brea.
Oh, no. Timothy, no.
I do like that. I was in Tar, but no, not Tar. Tar.
It kind of feels like the opposite of like the Amadeus conundrum, where it's always the Salieri that wins all the awards, being the main character. But in this one, it's like, what if Mozart went on to have the career?
Well, it's also like Amadeus in that there was that horror movie about the creature that emerges from the Amadeus tar pits.
Makes a fart sound when it comes out of the tar. Little bubbly farts. We meet Sybil Shepherd, who plays JC Farrow in the movie. And JC is the rich girl in town, right? She's from the richest family in town. Her mom is Ellen Burstyn in a performance that is so unspeakably good. In movies like this, you usually like see like the depressed housewife character, and they're usually just like kind of a monster,
yeah,
or like so deeply repressed they take it out on their kids. But
it's a
Lewis
very different
Farrow,
thing. This is a very different
very
kind
different
of relationship.
Character.
Yeah,
like she is living her best life. She is openly cheating on her husband,
yeah,
which is a very open secret in the town.
Yeah, kind of reminds me of like Diana Rigg in Game of Thrones. Just a woman who says everything the way that it is, right? And she knows how to kind of use the way things are constructed to benefit herself, and she tries to advise her daughter in the same way.
It's a very interesting and lovely relationship because her daughter, JC, might be like one of the best villains I've seen in a long time. Like, she is just monstrous for so much of this. And to prove this point, in like the first scene we see alone with her and her mom, she just shoves a cat off the bed so violently that you're like, that cat, I hope that cat's okay.
Oh, it's fine.
I know, cats always land on their feet, but still, it is a shocking bit of violence that I was not anticipating. So JC is dating Dwayne, and Dwayne is a very, let's say, jealous Texan boy at heart. And JC is trying, like, is being set up with like more rich folks, right? There's a very bizarre scene where she goes to a nude swimming party where everybody must be nude in order to swim. And there's I don't know how this keeps happening. There's just more child nudity, and I wish we would just stop. I wish
we'd
have like one movie.
These old movies. Yeah.
Yeah. What is going on?
Just keep the kids' clothes on, man.
For God's sake. So everybody gets, it's basically like an Eyes Wide Shut thing, but for like teenagers.
Yeah.
And they all get nude, and JC just starts like seeing some of the more rich boys in town, much to the chagrin of Dwayne, who keeps challenging people to fights, but is ultimately cucked at every turn.
This movie is basically Pride and Prejudice for 50s rednecks.
Oh,
right?
That's
great. It's a comedy of manners, and everyone is focused really on marriage and children in the future, right? And so much of like the conversations around sex, it's as though condoms don't even exist, like they don't even know about them. You know, this is before the pill, and so everything is all about like, how are you gonna like bag someone? How are you gonna sort of nail it down?
And I guess the answer to that most often is to have some of the most upsetting sex I've ever seen on film. Mm-hmm. It is deeply sad, and everyone in this movie wants a thing, doesn't get it, and then is emotionally devastated even when they get close to the thing that they want. I think the closest person to actually like filling that hole in her heart is Clarice Leachman's character, Ruth Popper, who is the wife of the coach of the football team that Sonny is on. And the coach is like, you know what, Sonny, I need you to go take my wife to the hospital for her checkup. And it's implied that she has cancer, question mark? Or like, I wasn't quite sure what exactly her malady was.
I don't think that's not what I took away from it, at least. I don't know.
I mean, she lives for a pretty long time, so I guess it's not cancer. But the way I love the way that she describes it. Sonny asks her, is it something bad? And she says, no, it's something dreary. And I think that's really lovely. I think that's a very poetic turn of phrase, particularly when I thought it was describing cancer. But maybe it's just that she is infertile, ultimately. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on?
I think it's just like some chronic thing that she's seeing to it. It didn't really strike me as something that was meant to be thought about a lot because of how they kind of just avoid it all the time.
Right.
It's just a thing that gets him to drive her to the hospital so that she can eventually start having sex with this kid.
Yeah, because she has Dr. Pepper in the fridge. Mm-hmm. That's how this whole thing starts. They start an affair together, and it's weird that the position the movie seems to take on this is that this child is sort of fully in control of like his faculties in it, or like it is unorthodox, but ultimately he is entering into it of his like own full volition. But I'm just like, he's a child. This is a child. This is a bad thing that's happening. This is a very bad scenario. And I would like it to stop, please.
Yeah, it's a pretty disturbing thing. I don't know how the movie's playing it then. I didn't find that to be the thing.
I think just because the way it ends up shaking out at the end, where he's screamed at so violently by her, it feels like the movie is more on her side than
I don't agree
his.
With that at all. No, I don't think the movie's on her side in any way. I feel like she's just, I think she's not a very good person, and I think that she's like desperate and alone. I mean, you never even see her like with her husband at any time. They don't share any screen time. She's always just at that house, and he's always just, he's got the most important job in town, which is being a shitty coach.
Yeah, for a terrible team that instantly improves the minute Sonny leaves it. It is interesting in all their scenes together that she's very like mothering towards him. Like she keeps wanting to like knit him a blanket or something that is his favorite color. And the way that she interacts with him when they're not having sex is very like motherly, which, you know, is I think what drove me down the path eventually of deciding that she actually couldn't have kids and that this was sort of her way of enacting.
I mean, I think
that.
that's definitely possible. I don't know if that's what she's going to the hospital for.
But yeah, it's certainly a chronic thing. And so Sonny's dealing with that, but there's just a lot of like other things happening in this town over the course of the year that we spend in it. The kids try and get Billy laid at one point with the town prostitute, and it's a deeply upsetting scene because Billy doesn't want to do it, and they're like, this will make you a man or whatever, and then they get barred from the store owned by this character named Sam the Lion.
He just owns all the actual businesses that are open.
Yeah, so he's like the last.
He owns the theater. And he owns the bar, the pool bar.
And he is sort of the last bastion of like this town of the Old West. He's basically the Old West incarnate. And he's played by this guy, Ben Johnson, who was sort of a staple of the John Ford films of the past.
He helped foil the gunpowder plot.
Oh, my God. On the 5th of November?
Yeah. You didn't know Ben Johnson did that was the playwright Ben Johnson. He was actually like responsible for.
I thought
uncovering
he was like
that.
in a film adaptation of like some old timey film about the gunpowder plot.
He just has the same name. As
oh man,
the playwright Ben Johnson.
It was I didn't recognize him without the mask.
The Ben Johnson mask.
Yes, very popular around Halloween. The Ben Johnson mask. Everyone
oh,
comes
you're
up
trying
to
reference
just like
Guy Fawkes.
Yeah, yeah.
But the guy who helped defeat him.
Yeah, it is always funny wearing a Ben Johnson mask at Halloween, and people are like, are you Shakespeare? It's like, I'm Ben Johnson.
Yeah, they do look exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
Marlowe too. I think there was just one guy doing all the portraits, and he just drew everyone, painted everyone to look like himself.
Yeah, with all of his face, and all the people are like, I don't know, man, I don't think that looks like me. He's like, trust me, man.
Are we all
this looks
going
exactly
bald?
Like
I don't
you.
Think so. I don't even have an earring.
But look, people are gonna assume you did. So why not just put it in there anyway? Come on, we're making you look cool, Billy Boy.
Yeah, the one portrait guy in London, just a real narcissistic. Like they all just look like you. He paints Queen Elizabeth, bald, mustache.
At least put a wig on me. Never.
Tiny little goatee.
Ooh-hoo. Ben Johnson is incredible in this movie.
Yeah, there's much better actor than writer.
Yeah, well. He's no Shakespeare or Marlowe.
No,
but,
he's neither.
Yeah. Even though he looks exactly the same.
He's a third guy.
Somehow a third Elizabethan playwright. But yeah, he delivers this monologue when he's at his old fishing watering hole. And Bogdanovich has this trick. He does like a slow zoom in shot. And he does this a couple times in the movie when like we're really like probing into like the inner lives of these characters. And he gives this monologue about his past and how he was there with a beautiful young woman and they race their horses across the creek, and how, you know, if he had like his one wish, he'd be able to like do it again. If she asked him, he would do it all over again. And it's this yearning and pining for an Old West that's pretty much gone now, because he is the last bastion of like, if this is 1951, he would have been born in like the 1900s, right? And it, like he would have seen the West die before his eyes, and that he is, once he goes and once he dies, you know, halfway through this movie, you lose a sense of what was entirely. And the 50s, particularly in these oil towns, were in this huge point of transition between that sort of old West cowboy days and modernization.
Yeah.
Right. And what it was like to sort of grow up in that limbo, having these pillars of your community be like, this is how it used to be. Just endless skies, horses. We were wild. We were young. We were free. Well, you know, most, you know, if you were white, you were free. But like, you know, this sort of romanticized idea of the West and what happens when they die.
Yeah.
And you're just left in this state of flux. And that's what I think this movie captures so beautifully.
And even Sam the Lion is just like, I don't know, like all these guys have is some chick that they fucked at some point in time. They don't really right. have anything else going on for them.
No, it's like they don't.
Whatever high school kid is doing the football game and whatever high school kid they're going to have sex with. And
yeah. Yep.
They project their entire lives into the like basically the 4 year span of these kids being in their last years of school. And
right.
and that is they such an incredible youth, amount yeah. of pressure to have to operate under as a teenager.
Because they are actively fetishizing your joy.
Yeah.
And if you are living in that time and not feeling that joy, then what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know? There's this sort of boiling sense of like, we have to amount to something because I don't want to be the old man sitting by this river remembering a time when I was that happy.
Yeah.
I want to do something different. But at every opportunity, it just eludes them.
Yeah. And you know, this is a movie coming out in 1971. So we're talking about like the dream of the hippies, and the dream of the hippies is to go away, to leave San Diego and go to San Francisco yeah. or to leave
right.
Ithaca and go to Woodstock, or, you know, you just have to, wherever it is that you are, get somewhere else, do it now. You've got to get away from your parents, get away from everybody else, which is a consequence of that mobility. You have enough money to go somewhere else for college and to do something else and to get away. And a lot of movies kind of deal with the sadness of not being able to do that, which is what this movie is. They don't actually, they're trapped here.
The sole exception, of course, being JC, who has
yeah.
the money
yeah.
to get out of town, but instead chooses to like go through every single one of her options.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. In order. And
yeah. In order.
And then you have the flip side of that, which is stuff like, I don't know, Five Easy Pieces, which is the sadness of having left. And having left it all behind, but you're still tethered to it in some way. And maybe
right.
it's like, maybe you're really just abandoning everyone when you do that. But who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, you do get to play piano on the back of a truck in Oklahoma.
I mean, that's something. That's yeah. what your childhood was like in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of run-ins with Jack Nicholson saying smarmy things to waitresses.
Oh,
I think that
man.
Was shot in Oklahoma. I think that's a Tulsa
I
movie.
Hope so.
Five Easy
yeah.
Pieces. Oh my God. Wait, no, I have to look it up now. I have to waste your time. No, but it wasn't actually
California.
Shot in Oklahoma. It was shot partly in Bakersfield, which is the Oklahoma of California.
Yeah, because it's set in
And apparently a lot of Canada.
California.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, in Vancouver Island. Yeah.
Which is the Oklahoma of. That's not true.
There you go. No.
That
justifies
true.
It.
I think Alberta is the Oklahoma of Canada.
Speaking of Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
JC and Sonny decide to make a fucking break for it and make their way up to Oklahoma to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, much to the chagrin of Cloris Leachman's character, who has been abandoned for somebody Sonny's own age. And this is kind of like if you got to see what happened after the end of The Graduate, because they realize halfway through driving, or at least JC does, that this was a horrible decision,
mm-hmm.
that she absolutely does not want to be tied down to Sonny and is very relieved when a cop pulls them over and makes them go back to Texas and get the marriage annulled. And then JC's able to go off to college, leaving Sonny behind. It's funny because like, This is sort of the moment in the film where we see that the reason JC has kind of felt like out of sync with everybody else in town is that she doesn't really belong here, and that she's been trying to like fit into the mm-hmm. piece, like herself into it. And that's been sort of her main conflict throughout the whole thing. But also that nobody really belongs in this town and they should all get the fuck out of there.
Yeah, no, this is a place that just makes you worse. That's all it does. It just ruins you. It gives you no enrichment whatsoever. Like all you can maybe hope to do is see a movie, and then that's gone once Sam dies.
It's funny because at Sam's funeral, Lois, who is Ellen Burstyn's character, everyone else is wearing black and she's wearing all white. Mm-hmm. And she's like actually having an emotion. She's like crying. She's carrying on. And it's almost like, okay, so there is a way to survive in this town and still be like a decent person, or at least to be like a full person that isn't completely crushed by it. But you have to like actively fight at every single turn.
She's so disconnected from the rest of the town. You know, and they have a TV. You know, that's an expensive thing to have in 1951. And so they're always watching TV. The radio is always on. It's sort of like MASH. There's always like, or American Graffiti. There's always music playing. You know, everybody's always listening to the radio, and you always hear the songs. Or like Northern Exposure. It's like
right. Oh, that's the reason why Northern Exposure couldn't be watched for a very long time. It's because a lot of that music.
And the version that's on Amazon now, they basically wrote new songs to sound like the songs that they were replacing. It was a very expensive project to replace music on that.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's a nice gig if you can get it.
To be some like uncredited, unlicensed stock music
sound alike. I think the thing that I love about this movie is that it really draws you in and doesn't let you escape from the misery of it. Like, it doesn't blink ever, which is really refreshing.
Yeah, the times when anyone leaves town, you don't follow them. Right. Sam dies because those two boys go down to Mexico and come back. Yeah. And all you see is them leaving and coming back. But it's like maybe a week has passed, something like that.
Right.
It's funny how that feels like MASH, too. It feels like, you know, they go and they get drunk. They come back, sombreros on and everything.
It's a very funny scene, actually, when we see them coming back and they're just completely decimated by their time in New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
In old Mexico. And they come back, and I mean, they really foreshadow Sam the Lion's death in a very big way.
I mean, that big speech is like, I'm gonna die in the next scene. I'm gonna die in the next scene. I fucked this 20-year-old. I'm gonna die in the next scene.
Enjoy Mexico. Here's some money for you. I hope to see you again at some point. And then it just lingers on for like a second too long. I'm like, oh, he's not gonna be in Rush Hour 3.
Yeah, it's like when Alan Alda and Horace and Pete leaves the bar and you just see his shadow behind the window, and you're like, oh, okay, that's it. Alan Alda's dead now.
Farewell! you feel his absence in the movie.
Yeah. He was the only one keeping up anything in the town that you could argue was worth anything.
Right, and not just going to Wichita Falls, which is where, from what I understand, the town of Wichita Falls contains exactly one motel, and that's where all the teens go to fuck each other.
Yes,
and
or don't.
Or don't.
In this case.
Yeah, okay.
Because they can't get an erection.
Yeah, okay. This is a question I had, and what did you get some gay vibes off of Dwayne and Sonny, or at least some bi vibes? Because
not any more than just like two guys are always kind of gay with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because I think it is nerves, obviously, the first time when he can't get it, when Jeff Bridges can't get it up for Sybil Shepherd. But then, I don't know, like the way they interact and like their chumminess together, I'm just like, this could be a friendship, or you could probably argue that
there
are some romantic feelings there.
And the
only way they can express them is through a bottle to the face instead of just smooching.
Right, they express it physically in fighting, which is even played around with in Brokeback Mountain, right? Every time that those guys like see each other, they start by kind of punching each other a little bit before they start kissing. Also, who was one of the co-writers of the Brokeback Mountain screenplay?
Was it Bogdanovich?
It was not Bogdanovich.
Oh, shit. It was Larry McMurtry?
Yes, Larry
the
McMurtry.
The writer of The Last Picture Show? That's so cool.
I said McMurtry earlier. I thought it was McMurtry.
Oh, I thought I heard you say McMurtry.
Well, that's because I said something that was very close to that, because I misread McMurtry as McMurtry. So then when you said McMurtry, I just tried to correct you, and then I was like, wait a second. Was I wrong?
Hang on.
I was wrong. But Larry McMurtry was one of the
McMurtry.
Writers. God, shit!
McMarty McFly. Larry McMurtry.
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 Martry McFlyry.
Flyer.
But yes, he was a co-writer on Brokeback Mountain. with Ang Lee.
All right, well, then you know what? It's decided. These two characters also a little gay.
I'm sorry, with Diana Ossana. I'm just wrong about everything today. Ang Lee is not a credited writer, which I thought he was on the
He usually doesn't actually help with the screenplays. He mostly does direction.
For some reason, I thought there was a credit there. That's just because I'm fucking stupid. Like everyone who lives in Texas.
Don't do this.
Well, it's where all my exes are.
Okay, I see. This is a lot of just you working through your country music.
Why did they all move there?
I don't know.
They lived in different places.
Brian, here's the worst part. They're all friends now. And all they talk about is you.
In Lubbock.
In Lubbock. They call you a big Lubbocks.
There we go. See? There's so many rhymes.
Lubbocks does not rhyme with Lubbock.
I know. It's an identity. And I guess an imperfect one. Writer chat.
Oh,
we love
Jesus.
Talking about the craft. But this movie was a huge hit, by the way. Last Picture Show made like $100 million on like a $10 million budget or something.
Look,
like
never underestimate the power of nostalgia, man.
Yeah.
50s nostalgia, particularly. I mean, it's 71.
It's nostalgia mixed with counterculture. It is like a sort of anti-nostalgia. It is like, I remember that. It sucked, which I think obviously people were kind of itching for. It was like both teenagers at this time seeing themselves in this movie and then also their parents seeing themselves in this movie, seeing the places that they probably left in order to go to college and then get a better job and never come back. And now a couple generations down, you have a bunch of people who are like, we should go back to this. And it's like, you are free to. Those houses cost like $2. You can go do it right now and you'll find out that it sucks.
Or even that, like, the people who watched this movie in 1971 feeling that way over the course of 14 years then became nostalgic for it.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, oh, God, I'm so glad I'm out of that place. To, like, 14 years later, being like, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe we should go back there.
Too many years. Too many.
Using some plutonium,
too many
perhaps.
Hours of cable TV. Too many years spent online on Facebook and then just pound after pound of COVID brain damage.
I do wonder what it would be like to do a double feature of Back to the Future and Last Picture Show.
Mm.
Like that is just such an interesting combination because they are diametrically opposed and yet to me rhyme in a very interesting
way. Well, they're about two
way.
different class positions too. You have rural, mostly poor kids. And even those kids who have money, you know, I mean, if you're a roughneck, you're typically making good money, but it's, again, it's going to go away. Like, you're not going to be able to keep that job for a very long time, and you're going to get fucked.
Yeah, and, you know, that would have happened to Dwayne had he not joined the army, which he does decide to do.
Yeah. In this sequel, what has he been doing since then?
He's an oil guy.
Okay.
He just gets into oil in a big way. Once he gets back from the war. Again, I did not watch a lot of it, but I just wanted to like make sure. I just kind of wanted to see, because I was interested after this movie ended, like what happened to everybody. And it was mostly that everybody was just kind of fine, like really sad, but fine. The person I didn't get to was Cloris Leachman comes back.
Mm.
And I'm like, I wonder what the fuck her character is up to in the sequel.
Yeah, I don't want to know. Like, that's such a weird thing to. I had no idea that he made a sequel to this thing, because it's like that. This is the story. This is the whole thing.
Yeah, like it encapsulates so much.
Like, I understand Francois Truffaut making sequels to The 400 Blows to let us know what child Francois Truffaut is up to. And it's like, you're still alive. But like, what else is there to tell here? This is supposed to feel like hell.
Right. I think it's more that Bogdanovich talks about that movie a lot, about what it feels like to go through a midlife crisis. And that's sort of what he was dealing with. And it was very personal to him because he himself was going through that same crisis at the same time. So that was the territory it was trying to mine. It's just that this time in The Last Picture Show is just so much more dramatically fulfilling, because it's not, it's ennui, but it's like, the town itself is actively fighting against you. Mm-hmm. So there's more of a conflict there. Even when you are just trying to live your life, it isn't living, it's survival, in a way that middle age is just like, it's dealing with a more abstract concept of like legacy and, you know, incoming or like seeing death for the first time. on the horizon.
And I can see where Peter Bogdanovich finds like a resonance with this. He's not a Texan, obviously, but he's from Kingston, New York is the name of the town, which is about the size of Gallup.
Sure.
Like, it's a town of 24,000 people today, probably less, you know, when he was a kid. And he must have read this book and been like, oh, yeah, I know this shit. I remember what this was like.
Yeah, I see myself in that small town and how it meant and what it felt like to try to escape it. Because, you know, there's a great scene where Sonny just like fully drives out of town trying to abandon it. And then he can't. Right. He turns around because he has to, because there's this sort of horrible gravitational force of this black hole that is the town that pulls him back in.
It's Vladimir and Estragon on that road.
Truly, truly. After Sam dies, it turns out that the picture show can't sustain itself. Mm-hmm. And it happens. The last picture show, the titular last picture show, is happening the night before Dwayne decides to leave. He's being sent to Korea. Yeah. He's been shipped out.
And Sam willed that theater to someone who really doesn't know how to run a business and would not like to run a business. So she's like, I'll keep it going for a few weeks, I guess. And and I just can't.
And the last picture show they decide to show is a film called Red River.
Yeah.
Which is a John Wayne it's a John Wayne picture that was directed by John Ford, and it is the Old West incarnate, right?
Yeah.
This is like if I wanted to introduce somebody to symbolism, I would sit them down and just watch this scene of these characters watching the Old West die in front of them.
And this also speaks to Red River is actually a Howard Hawks movie. Howard Hawks directed it, not John Ford.
My apologies.
It's I feel like John Ford is a mood. John Ford is also like a style.
Right, right. He is a genre unto himself.
But it's like, it's a well-regarded movie, but it's not a historically significant one. It's not one that people are like, oh yeah, Red River. You know, like,
you can say,
oh yeah, The Last Picture Show, and people will be like, well, I haven't seen it, but I know what you're talking about. I've heard of it. Red River does not have that stature. Right.
It's not How the West Was Won.
And
it's not.
Yeah. You know, and it speaks to like How the West Was Won, which no one has watched because it's not very good, but we all know it.
Right. Fistful of Dollars. That's
Fistful of Dollars or Fort Apache, Stagecoach, The Searchers, something like that.
Yeah.
They're always watching these kind of minor movies or you know, I'm seeing it on the screen or whatever. I'm like, what the hell are they watching? And I had to go look it up.
This?
You know,
yeah.
At this point in 1951, Red River's like 3 years old. So this also speaks to like how theaters used to work. You didn't just have the new movie and that was it. It was just stuff would kind of play through. You had the one screen and they'd get whatever they could get. This would be like a secondary market. So they're not going to see anything when it's brand new.
It's just what reels do we have?
Yeah.
And what vibes are we feeling? Which is really lovely because I actually think that a lot of movie theaters, like local movie theaters here in New York, are also starting to do that because I think they're realizing that the actual way to get people out of their houses to stop streaming movies is to like play old 35 millimeter prints of things they watched when they were younger. Like, why stay home and watch, you know, Homeward Bound on Disney Plus when you could watch it in 35 millimeter at the local Nighthawk?
You really don't understand Homeward Bound until you see it at the Nighthawk.
He's crawling up that mud pit. He's sliding back down. You have to be with an audience going, come on, Shadow.
That's
such a tussle
he gets into with the porcupines.
Such a tussle.
I knew the little kid from Homeward Bound. He went to Calvin.
Let's get him on the show.
His younger brother lived on my floor in the dorms. Yeah. He didn't grow very big at all. He's like still kind of a short guy, which meant that he was really good up in the lighting grid, just sort of crawl around on top of it.
He wasn't going to be held back for football is what you're saying.
No. Well, I mean, I don't know. My brother was held back for football and he should not have been. That boy was so skinny. It's like this skinny, like freckly redheaded kid who loves like reading and speaks clearly. Like my brother, God, you hear him talk when he's like 2 years old, probably because my dad has some hearing problems. Everything that he says is always so clear and well enunciated. I'm like, that's not a kid who's going to play football. They're like, we see that kid. We got to give him some CTE. We got to level him out a little bit. Like,
Yeah. It's also, but every football team needs at least one player who could try to talk the other side out of playing. Right. That's a viable strategy.
Yeah. If every football game worked the way that they like did war in the Bible times, where you like you draw a line and then you have your biggest guys come up and try to negotiate with each other.
Yeah, it's a duel. It's duel
that
logic.
Works really
the
well.
Game wouldn't happen.
Works really well until Tom Brady comes and brings a sling and shoots it across because he's a cheater. He cheats.
Like David?
Yes, he's a cheater.
David's not a cheater. He hits him with a
he's
rock.
He's a fucking cheap shot. Come on.
All right. Fair. take some air out of the rock before he throws it. So,
he films all their giants to see if he can learn to become giant like them.
We're going into this episode and we're thinking, how can we alienate both the South and New England at the same time with one episode? And Brian, I think we did it.
Yeah.
I think we did it. So the picture show's closed.
Yeah.
It's gone. Ripped to a real one. Dwayne drives off into the sunset, probably not to be killed in Korea. They sort of like make amends at the end, Sonny and Dwayne. That whole relationship is patched over. But oh no, turns out that Billy got run over by a truck.
Yeah.
In a truly harrowing scene that destroyed me emotionally.
And it's like all the guys talking, it seems like they're all out of towners. And they mostly just want this inconvenience to be out of the way. It's
the way
truck
they talk
driver
about,
and
the way they talk about Billy is like he's an animal. He's like roadkill. Yeah. Like they just hit a deer or something.
Like I don't even know what he was doing out here. And he says he was sweeping, you sons of bitches.
And he picks him up, and we watch Sonny like just move. And the metatextual knowledge of just knowing that this is his like kid brother that he is picking up and moving to the side, like that really got me in a profound way. He uses his Letterman jacket to like to put over Billy's face. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's also just a wonderful bit of symbolism there of him literally casting off his youth and putting it on top of Billy. It's a heartrending scene. This was the point where I was just like, I needed to pause and take a little walk around the apartment.
It was the end.
There's a scene after it, right?
Oh, there is the scene with Cloris Leachman. Yeah.
There's the scene with Cloris Leachman where he goes back to her and needs to be taken care of because he's lost everything. He's basically like he's the last one standing in this town. Everyone that he's interacted with in the movie is either dead or gone.
Yeah.
And so he goes back to her and she's like, fuck you. Mm-hmm. You fucking left me. And she throws the coffee at the wall because she asks if he wants coffee or whatever. And then she just throws the kettle at the wall. And I love the detail that the coffee grounds just like stay on the fridge, like the entire scene. It's just like this. I don't know. It's so tactile and so I don't know. Like it wouldn't like really harp on it, I think, in any other movie, but it just feels so lived in and so real. And she's just like, I will never take care of you. I won't help you because fuck you. You hurt me. And then he just kind of gives her the puppy dog eyes. And then she like holds his hand and says, I guess we'll take care of you after all, because he's just so fucking pathetic. And they're
and she's
sort of
deeply, deeply union. Diseased.
Yeah. Yeah. She is truly fucked up. And she, I mean, the performance that Cloris Leachman gives in this movie is so fucking good. It's so heartbreaking. And you really feel for this character who does truly monstrous things. But their union together is the basis of the town, right? It's these two survivors coming together in the face of overwhelming tragedy. Together holding hands at the end of the picture, and that's it. That's the movie. Oh, I should mention there's no score in this movie, which I think is really wonderful. Everything is diegetic in the film, and it's all like this very haunting like Western music, but it kind of feels like ghosts made
it also like, it also repeats a lot. Like you're just hearing the same fucking radio station playing the same music over and over and over again.
Like you are stuck with these characters in this town in the same way. Like the gravitational force has sucked you fully into this thing. And I think that's the magic trick of the movie. It looks back in anger in a way that a lot of coming of age films don't or refuse to engage with in quite the visceral way that this one does. So Brian, is this movie a fancy feast? Or a failure to fancy.
Yeah, it's a fancy feast. I think it's a really good movie about America and about one of the most mythologized points in time in American history. and it spares nothing, and it really just makes you want to die. So that always a sign of a good film right there.
Yeah.
What about you, AJ? What kind of a movie is this, feast wise, fancy wise?
This is a fancy feast for me, man. I think that it's not a movie I'm going to return to a lot, just because it makes you feel a lot of really depressing shit.
Yeah, I hate
but
feeling.
Like, the performances across the board in this thing are just unparalleled. And I don't know. It is such a singular film. I don't think I've not seen a lot of movies, granted, but I don't think I've ever seen a coming of age movie that fully engages with how shitty it is to be young in quite the same way, that comes at it not with kid gloves, but with like full-eyed clarity. It is a remarkable film. So Brian, what are we doing next month?
Well, so we haven't done a Japanese movie on here yet, have we?
I don't think
so,
no.
I recommend something earlier and then I changed my mind. We did Hoffman instead. So why don't we take a look at Akira Kurosawa's Ikiru?
Oh,
not
hell
one
yeah,
of his
dude.
Period movies, one of his modern day movies. It's one that I have neglected to see. I have seen a lot of Kurosawa movies and I've always kind of been like, okay, I'll watch this one next, and I never get to it, so this time I'm gonna get to it.
Hell yeah, it's one of Bill Hader's favorite films.
It sure
did,
is
one of his Criterion Collection closet things was Ikiru. So I'm so stoked. Ah, oh, man, what a joy. Hopefully it's not a downer, right? Right?
I think it's something of a downer, yeah.
So from all of us here at Fancy Movie Time. Oh god, I'm Fancy AJ.
And I'm Fancy Brian.
Oh, stay fancy, friends! Wait, what show is this?